Welcome. This is William Evans, and we're shifting gears. Our guest today is Michael Thompson, a basalt architect, a longtime friend of fruit trees, and observant of the water around him. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you, Will. Happy to be here.
What can you tell us about the history of basalt's water system?
Well, let's see. We had, when we moved here, my wife and I, in 79, the water system in basalt, we didn't know anything about it then, but looking at it later, I learned that that it was, basically it was based on the land above the town of Basalt, Basalt Mountain. And there are a lot of springs on Basalt Mountain, and the family that originally settled this hillside area was the Luxinger family. And they had land up on Basalt Mountain. They had hay fields up there, etc. And the water on Basalt Mountain was called Luxinger Springs. That was the first water organized to feed the town. And basically, to cut the story short, one of my daughters came home from college in around about 2004 or 5, and she tasted the water and said, "What happened? What happened to the water?" I said, "I don't know." And so I looked into it, and turns out I discovered that it's actually in the newspapers that Division of Wildlife was told by the federal government to stop leasing parts of their land to the town and others, and to take the water that they were giving for leasing to the town and use it to support wildlife. So the meadows above town have long since been sold back to the Division of Wildlife or Colorado Parks and Wildlife now, are now being irrigated with that water for winter elk deer populations. So it's went up on Basalt Mountain to just look at this water, how it flows down the hill, disappears from the ground, out of the ground further down, flows a little, goes back in the ground, and keeps on going until it comes down to Lake Christine. And seeing that water flowing 2 years after the fire was really inspiring, because you can see how nature succeeds a fire, comes back with certain plants, and how they feed the area and get the roots down in the soil to hold on to it. So it's just really thrilling to see.
Wow, what a story.
Yeah, many of our mountains are filled with underground water. And when I saw some of the springs on Basalt Mountain, a bunch of my friends and I used to ride our mountain bikes up there. Very difficult terrain to ride in because there's so much old growth trees, and one of them falls a diameter tree across the trail. Just virtually impossible to keep it clear. And we did review a path we had forged, basically linking these trails together. We reviewed it with the Forest Service way, way back in the 80s. And they said, "No, don't. We're not going to let you do this." So we took our constructive efforts elsewhere and helped them to build the Hay Park Trail instead. Basalt Mountain is really a tough place to have kind of a mountain bike trail. There are some on the backside, but connecting the backside and the front side really does cross some new territory, filled with wildlife, bears and mountain lions and deer and elk, all kinds of stuff, and I'm really thrilled to see it left alone.
And so Basalt Mountain is volcanic.
Yes. Basalt rock is like a sponge. And yes, when you go up on Basalt Mountain, you're coming across what we call talus fields. Very large areas that are nothing but car-sized boulders. And they're all full of holes because from hot magma. And fascinating to cross one of these fields, because you're kind of jumping from one rock to another, and be really, really careful to step only on embedded rocks, not on perched ones. Perched ones may be imbalanced, and you don't want to end up in one of them. So, yeah, it's difficult terrain to cross, and you can see the little patches of soil and trees and underbrush in between these fields where the wildlife trails are, so it's really easy to find where the pathways are, because the elk and the deer do not cross those older fields. So it's fascinating to see how the whole pattern of nature is on the mountain, and to remember what it was like before the fire and to see it now. Just fields of waist-high wildflowers and weeds of all kinds. Sticking out of them are all these old dead skeletons of trees. Black charred. Fascinating landscape.
In addition to being very porous, as you say, being able to soak up water like a sponge, a volcanic mountain, many of them have what are called lava tubes. And so where you quickly described to us that the water would disappear and reappear, it's probably diving into a lava tube and then reemerging.
Sure. I don't know how, you know, what's going on underground. It would be fascinating to see if ever technology could deliver us a picture of what's happening there. But there is one place on Basalt Mountain that I love, which is a hillside of this talus. There's a watercress going all through it, and you know, it's an area the size of a house, and the water just comes out, flows out of the hillside, comes a stream, goes for about 200 yards, and disappears in the ground again. It comes out about 600 feet lower than a half a mile away into a pond. So it is fascinating to see sort of chalice, where water appears and then disappears and then appears again in another place, and how the wildlife congregates around each of these places, how the vegetation is so different.
And so say a little more about the quality of this water.
Well, for years I have gone to this one place, water comes straight out of the hill below the top of the Salt Mountain. And just brought with me a tuna fish sandwich or something, and go sit on these rocks in the middle of this flow. And just dip my water bottle into the water and drink it, and put some of that watercress on my tuna fish sandwich and eat it. And the water is just, it's an experience I can't describe. Just sweet. Cold. It's really, really cold. It must be 40 degrees or something. And it's just delicious water.
Well, and it's source water at a pristine level of really a life-giving essence and substance.
Right. You can see the life-giving aspect of it. All this watercress growing there, all the life around, all the flowers, and signs of wildlife, but they don't go out in the middle of this spring on the rocks, because they could get in trouble. They're dainty little feet, but just to see the water comes out of the mountain, becomes life, goes back into the mountain, and in between these places, the vegetation is far more sparse.
It's continually being filtered as it dives down through the lava again, and then reemerges down the slope. And did I understand correctly, you didn't pick up the change in the taste, but your daughter did?
Yeah, I didn't notice it. It was kind of like, being here, it sort of seemed like a gradual thing, or maybe it was because I sometimes mix my water from the tap with something else like iced tea or flavor the water somehow. And I didn't notice it. She did because she was away from it, came home and said what happened. So it was fascinating that story of losing the Luxinger Springs town water supply. So the town went to wells and bought additional water storage, more water treatment. And I've had other people visit from far away and say, yes, I do taste some chlorine in your water. And there is chlorine in our water now. That's kind of a safety measure, I suppose, but it's not what it used to be.
Well, and you know, we have to be watching the quality of water in well water more and more with all the things that get poured onto the ground and into the toilet.
Right. One other fascinating thing I learned in just looking into the water situation and living in our house on the hillside since 1983 was that the water system arrived in sometime in the 30s, and electricity arrived in 1941 here in Basalt, but was only a couple weeks before Pearl Harbor, so the lights came on and then they went right back off because that power was needed for the war effort. But the water system came to the houses on the hillside before the sewer system did. And I know that because when I was working in my side yard between my house and the alley, I found an old pit underground that was about 6 feet cube, and it was covered over with cedar logs, the juniper tree, which is highly resistant to rot. And then it was covered over with smaller branches, and then it was covered over with dirt, and then it was covered over with bricks. And I never knew there was anything under there. But what it was, when I uncovered it, it was there was a pipe going through it from the kitchen that had been abandoned. So they got the water, then they had to build a little, rather large dry well for the wastewater to go to. And then later, of course, the sewer came into play, and municipal utility. But fascinating to see how the settlers originally did carry water to their homes, and then they got water piped because they didn't have a sewer. And there was an outhouse too. I have been into the ground in my backyard and found some evidence of an old outhouse.
This is KDNK, and you're listening to Shifting Gears. We're conversing with Michael Thompson about the source water from Basalt Mountain. So, what's your relationship with source at this point in time?
With Earth?
Source.
With source?
Yes, source.
Well, it's fascinating to think about. Your book reminded me many different things. One of the main things that really struck me is when the young lady Nettie in the book is asking about whether humans can be keystone species. And the description of, you know, keystone species, like we all know the story of the wolves of Yellowstone, how they were driven out and then just recently brought back in, and how we were able to observe how the ecosystem had gotten out of balance in their absence and how they restored that balance when they came back. So they are a keystone species that keeps the ecosystem in balance. And humanity would have to shift quite a bit to become a keystone species, keeping everything in balance. It seems to all of us that our role seems to be to keep everything out of balance. In an ecosystem manner, by using nature as a resource rather than understanding it as a source, described in the book. There's a young lady that grew up here on the hillside. Parents are just friends of ours, and she's very, very much involved in the permacultures, helping Jerome and learning all that he had to teach about the ecosystem balance in greenhouses and out in forest gardens. And she had, you know, my daughter's babysat her. She was, as she grew up, I could observe that she had this incredible fascination for anything that moved, any life form, any bug, any insect, a slug, anything. And she would pick it up like, who are you, you know? And to have that kind of understanding that we're not, it's not just us, and then everything else is a resource for us to use up. She had this sort of attitude of, here I am on the planet, and who are you, you know? What's your role? So this knowledge, this sort of attitude that every life form, even the ones we can't see, have a role to play. And this sort of large-scale source. And if we take any aspect of that, any part of that, any mineral, any life form, plants or animals, and we treat it as a resource, use it up, we have no right to do that. We're a crew on Spaceship Earth, Fuller say, and everyone else is also a crew on Spaceship Earth. And No species has a right to wipe out another. So we need to get that attitude, to adopt that attitude. All life is precious and it needs to be supported. And maybe in a couple thousand years we can be a keystone.
Well, it's certainly an amazing time to be here because I'm watching a lot of young people figuring out how we can have a living world relationship with Source and stop the consequences of our immature and our ill-informed behavior with unintended consequences.
Yes, young people are they're the hope, and I've gotten to know quite a lot of young people in many different ways. I work with Jerome at the Permaculture Institute, partially teach some of the academy courses in the permaculture design course, and most of the people are young people. Also, my daughters growing up here and going off to college and bringing friends home, I got to meet a lot of their friends. And so I know a lot of young people, and they, in many ways, they don't deserve optimism because of, you know, how difficult their path might be in front of them when climate change and pandemic and all kinds of other economic situations seem to be getting worse. Yet they're optimistic. And I know they're optimistic because they're having children. And they're also virtually all of them. I don't know any of them that are trying to extend the status quo from the Industrial Revolution through the oil economy. They're all bent on rebuilding the energy economy, rebuilding the local food economy. I think that's very healthy where they're headed. My job is to support them. We have many examples of them here at Invardi and the Farm Collaborative up at Cozy Point, Vermeens, and Roots Farm, Aaron's Acres, Wild Mountain Seeds, all these young farmers who are feeding us and are expanding and building more food capacity here in the valley. Amazing. And I've witnessed truly amazing during this recent Grizzly Creek fire, when the fire erupted on the highway in Glenwood Canyon.
Right.
They had to shut the highway down, use that as a base camp for fighting the fire on both sides as it went up into the flat tops and up toward Missouri Heights. The highway was shut down. So we had shelves empty in the supermarket. And everyone witnessed that. It was like the second time.
Right.
After the pandemic had been announced, they emptied. And then after this fire happened and we had I-70 closed for 3 weeks, same thing happened. Yet our local food stores, Mana Foods in Carbondale and Skip's Farm to Market in DeSalt, were plenty of supply of food because it came from our local farmers. So that was a good emphasis to me that there are many things that can interrupt. It could be a snowstorm. It could be, like it was this time, a fire. It could be a flood. Could be many different things. And having a local food economy gives us another level of security.
So 2-3 years ago, you called me and told me you sensed we needed to prepare ourselves locally for big changes and learn how to cooperate. How is that coming?
I think it's going very well. We have the local food economy is growing very quickly. We did have this year during the pandemic. I got calls from some of the farmers and from one of the Pickens County commissioners saying, how can we expand local food production this year? How can we get more local food into the food bank? Everyone knows that the food bank became very, very important here everywhere, here in the valley, because industries had to shut down. They had to shut down for the most part, and a lot of jobs were on hold or people were laid off, and it took the government a long time to come up with any stimulus at all, and it wasn't enough. So the food bank became very important. What ended up happening is that through the Two Forks Club, where Ed and Vardy is our director, a number of people who had plenty of resources donated money to be invested with our local farmers. And each farmer who took some of that took it on as a loan, and as a forgivable loan if they they gave 50% of their expanded produce to the food bank. And so the food bank got a lot more food. Local people out of work, got a lot more help, and it was a great way for the community to come together.
So, wonderful.
There are, beautiful stories of how local people recover from things. And when we had that conversation with the community at the Basalt Library, two years ago this winter, it was, I don't think any of us, I certainly didn't imagine that it would be a pandemic that would close the economy down. I thought it would be government or corporate or banking malfeasance that would cause another recession. But this was most fascinating to see how the entire world economy had to go into hibernation. How do we do that? We need to know how to do that. And I think local economies, especially local food economies, will be more realized and be an important part of that.
Yeah, some nations even have a alternative currency as a backup for exchanges in such a time.
Yes. When we had that conversation with, I don't know, we had 30 or 40 people in the library, three different sessions. We were exploring how many communities in the United States are creating their own local currencies. They all have to be somewhat based on the dollar. You do have to pay income taxes on it.
Except in the case of time dollars.
Around it, but you were the one, Will, who told me years ago about something we now call the gift economy. I've been exploring that tremendously. I have some friends who are hunters, and and I am a 22-year home brewer of beer, and they love my beer, and they give me meat when I give them beer. There's no negotiation. I don't tell them, you know, I'll give you this much for that much, nothing like that. It's just when I have beer ready, I call them, and they come and get it. I give it to them freely, and they bring me back the empties, and they bring me back some meat. And I have other relationships in the community that are similar to that, as well as good trading that we do with all the gardeners. And, you know, these are, we have soil. I have a little yard. I save my seeds. I plant them every year, and I get more food coming. I share it with my gardening friends.
Yeah, I love to come visit you, Michael, because I bring a gift and you bury me in gifts. Thank you so much.
You are welcome. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. You've been listening to Shifting Gears and a conversation with Michael Thompson about source and exchange.